Cool, Josh squealed. I don't care what any of these people think. Let's suit up. And we were off. We ran down the decorated hall to our room, high-fiving Nick's Chicks poster on the wall, put on our bikinis, threw our dresses on top, and beelined it to the hot tub. By the time we got to the edge, I was amped on adrenaline, screaming, "Cannonball!" as I started my approach, but the shadow of something made me stop myself from launching in at the last second. "Oh, hello," I said to a figure in the hot tub. Upon closer look, it was the silhouette of a woman, just as Ariel from The Little Mermaid, her face hidden in the darkness. "Sorry, we didn't see that anyone was in here." "That's okay," she said quietly, emerging into the night. She had really gone all out. Mermaid tail, shell bra, red wig. I stared at her. Something about her was so familiar. Then it hit me. I started imagining her normal eyes replaced with massive baby doll ones, and her regular mouth with huge fake lips, her labrae piercing switched with, holy shit, it was mysterious. Jocelyn and I realized this at the exact same moment, as evidenced by us grabbing each other's hands like we were Thelma and Louise before they drive off the cliff. We slowly backed away as she retreated into the shadows. "Have a great night, Mysterious," I said before we took off. As soon as we reached our rooms, we cracked open a bottle of red to toast. Screw that deck party. We were just fine whooping it up in our sardine can. The next morning, the sun peeked through the blinds as the ship continued through the windy seas. It was our last full day and night on the cruise, and there was no port stop, just another full 24 hours on this island of BSB Atches. We decided to skip out on such riveting activities as taking a cooking class with Brian and his wife, brilliantly named Cooking with the Latrells. I mean, did they even try to be creative when naming these classes? This was Latrell-ly the worst name they could have chosen. Ba-da-ching! Instead, we were choosing to get a little day drunk at the bar and then take a nap. We had the acoustic performance to look forward to that night, but we were prepared to sleep through everything else. When we got back to our room, we were adequately tipsy and ready to conk out. Before I could swan dive into my bed, though, I noticed that our phone was blinking. "That's weird. We have a voicemail," I said, pushing the button and holding my breath. Oh, what a nightmare it would be if there was an emergency back home and we were stuck at sea, I thought to myself. I started flipping through the Rolodex of possible disaster scenarios, then hit play to put myself out of my misery. "Hi, this is," insert name here, "calling for Marmy Hart." Honestly, after 30-something years of having my name mispronounced, this didn't even elicit an eye roll. "Hi, Marmy. This is kind of random, but I work with the Backstreet Boys, and Kevin's bodyguard, Keith, is also his best friend since childhood. Anyway, Keith's daughter saw that you're on this cruise and is a big fan. We were wondering if you could meet him and sign an autograph. Call me back when you have a sec." I hung up the phone slowly and looked at Jocelyn, shaking my head. "Oh my God, what? Is everything okay?" I sat on the edge of the tiny bed. I could hear her own disaster Rolodex slipping at lightning speed. "Mamrie, what is it?" I took a deep breath, raised my head to meet her eyes, and smiled. "We're one step closer to Kevikev." Within 5 minutes of chatting with the lady who left the voicemail, Joss and I were walking to the piano bar to meet this Keith so I could help a dad grab some street cred for his no-doubt angsty teen with great taste in YouTube content. "You're Mamrie?" he asked, with a bit of disbelief in his voice. I think he was expecting another Mysterious or Kevin's Angel, not two normally dressed chicks who had an air of being over it. "You know it," I said, before grabbing his phone to record a video for his daughter, letting her know how cool her dad was. "I can't thank you enough. She's gonna freak out. Hey, you should come to the after party tonight." Joss and I shot each other a look. "To be honest, Keith, we haven't loved the parties. It's kind of a shit show." I couldn't help but be truthful to his sweet, good old boy Kentucky face. "Oh, I know. The fans can get a little, let's just say, intense." We chatted for a bit, and he got my number so he could text me his daughter's reaction. Jocelyn and I said goodbye and headed back to the room, disappointed. We'd gotten 1 degree closer to Kevin, but no cigar. Laying on our tiny beds that afternoon, we decided we'd go to the show and then call it an early night. We needed to be fresh for Madrid. The show itself was totally excellent and worth putting up with the screaming throng of women behind us. Truly, you haven't lived until you've watched the Backstreet Boys sit on stools, singing acoustic versions of I Want It That Way and Backstreet's Back. Was it cheesy? Yes. but like a finely aged Parmigiano Reggiano lightly dusted over the best goddamn pasta you've ever eaten. After their fifth encore, we pushed ourselves through the throngs of formal dresses and went back to our room, ready to call it a night. All of a sudden, my phone dinged like a text was coming through. "That's crazy," I said, picking up my phone. "Nothing has come through since we left Italy. Watch this be AT&T tell me I've got roaming charges from the sea the whole time." The text read, "Girl, where you at? Come hang. I want you to meet Kevin. Keith." I dropped my phone and looked at Jocelyn. "Mamrie, I swear to God, that face, unless someone died this time, that face is not okay," she said. "Oh, you's about to die," I said, handing her my phone. She read the text to herself, locked eyes with me, and then we both crashed through the door at high speed, getting stuck like we were Lucy and Ethel. We ran through the boat. Everyone had gotten out of their rhinestone prom attire to get decked out for the final theme, 50 Shades of Backstreet. For those of you over 30, it looked like a lost segment from the show Real Sex that used to be on HBO in the 90s. It wasn't the type of crew you were used to seeing decked out with a leather crop. It was more like walking in on your fifth grade social studies teacher in a sex dungeon. We pushed our way through the pleather and up to the front lounge of the boat to find Keith. Guys, I'm not going to go into all the details of the night because they are both surreal and super blurry. But let's just say that within 30 minutes, Jocelyn and I were sitting in a private room with Keith and Kevy Kev, drinking a bottle of Pappy Van Winkle and laughing our asses off. Kevin was wearing lace across his eyes for the night's theme, and I believe I told him it looked like he had ratchet panties on his face. At one point, I looked over, and Jocelyn was telling him all about how we came on the cruise because we loved him in the dock. It was weird and perfect and, sadly, totally innocent, because he is a married man. You can go look at the picture of us from that night, and I'm pretty sure my face says it all. We somehow made it back to our room and passed out happy for what felt like about 5 minutes before someone was banging on our door. "No, thank you," Jocelyn mumbled, thinking it was housekeeping. But they wouldn't stop knocking. I looked at the clock on my phone. It was 7:30 a.m. Mind you, we hadn't gone to sleep till 5:30, and I only know this from checking my Snapchat. I dragged myself to the door, only to discover a very stern-looking captain. I'm talking full-on an officer in a gentleman white suit. "You gotta be out! This boat is leaving!" "We'll be out in 5, I croaked. Jocelyn and I were zombies. The blasting of the cruise ship's horn felt like a personal attack on our irresponsibility of oversleeping and our hangovers. But it didn't matter. We zipped up our ramshackle suitcases, pulled up the handles, and high-fived without saying a word. We came, we saw, we kevy-kevved. Ratchet panties and all. Pity Party. By the time summer officially started, I was exhausted. Between Paris and Amsterdam and the cruise, I'd spent more time abroad than I had in my new house. Not that I was complaining. This globetrotting was exactly what I needed to distract me from my life. It had felt good to get out of L.A., away from the memories and responsibilities, and just let loose. That spring had been one giant spring cleaning to deal with the breakup. And wouldn't you know it, it worked. Everything from losing my shit in Paris to being stoned and crying to the Dixie Chicks singing Landslide while being the cream to my friend's Oreo had gotten everything out of my system. It's like I'd been a sponge filled with guilt and sadness and just plain grieving. Those trips wrung out that sponge, and now I was ready to enjoy my clean brain, not to mention absorb some new love along the way. Part of me believed that once word of my newly single status got out, there would be a proverbial running of the bulls with me in a red cocktail dress hauling ass from an onslaught of men. I was equally terrified that there would be radio silence, that I would go, "Hey, everybody, guess who's single?" into an abyss, check my watch, and then after 5 minutes, a male voice would finally echo back, "No one cares." My friends assured me that my dating skills would come back like second nature. I am here to tell you that, sadly, it was not as easy as they claimed. While I was cozy in my relationship, all of these advancements in dating had happened. I felt like I had been thawed out after being cryogenically frozen for a decade, or like I was Kimmy Schmidt emerging from the bomb shelter, saying weirdo dated phrases like "talk to the hand," texting, DMs, sexy Snapchats. None of this had existed when I was single. I met my ex in 2006. Back then, if someone said dating app, they were probably referencing the mozzarella sticks they got at Chili's during their last date. Texting was just a way to communicate where you were going to meet, and that was the end of it. None of this flirting via text and waiting for a text back for a certain amount of extremely anxiety-producing time. The word emoji didn't even exist. And forget about sending a sassy over-the-shoulder butt shot. The quality of flip phones was so bad, your ass would have been an 8-bit. Despite my apprehension, I was determined to polar bear plunge back into the scene and finally go on a date. My first date since 2006. I started asking my friends to hook me up with someone, figuring that a friend of a friend approach would be a safe way to get back into it. Their response was inevitably, "What's your type?" I'd say, tapping my chin. I would say my ideal type is like a Courier New or a Times New Roman. Once they finished rolling their eyes, turns out not a lot of people are fans of font jokes, they would still be waiting for an answer that I didn't have. My previous boyfriends from high school on were all very blonde, blue-eyed, almost Nordic-looking dudes. But I wouldn't say that was my type. Maybe I wanted to date a dark-haired, bearded guy, or a guy covered in tats, or a Spanish guy, or an Indian guy. I was ready for my dating life to be an Epcot of possibilities. While I didn't have physical requirements on lock for my future beau, I did have a specific list of personality traits I was looking for. I told my friends to hook me up with any of their hot, successful, funny, ambitious, kind, did I mention funny, friends. Tall order, right? Oh, I forgot tall. Add that in there too. And it was tough. I remember sitting with Jocelyn, racking our brains over a bottle of sparkling rosé about who I could date. Every name mentioned was someone who was either married, had a serious girlfriend, or just came out. And then I remembered a guy I'd done a show with a year or so earlier. He was handsome and funny, but definitely married. "Not anymore," Jocelyn said between sips. "Homeboy is divorced." "I'm just gonna throw it into the universe," I said, holding up my pink bubbles in the candlelit oyster bar. "Universe, I would like to go on a date with so-and-so." I felt ready. I felt bold. I felt like we should open another bottle of rosé, and damn it, we did. The next morning, I had to get some coffee in my bloodstream to make up for the rosé-a-thon. I hopped in that hot new car of mine and popped over to my local coffee shop. Windows down and latte in hand, I drove back to my house, eager for the day ahead. And just as I rolled up to a stop sign, there, across from me, was the dude in his car. I had manifested him. Literal man-ifestation. We both proceeded through the stop sign, rolling past each other slowly with our windows down, definitely checking each other out. But it was too fast to say hi. I immediately sent him a DM on Twitter. You know, the modern-day Civil War letter romance. And basically said, "We just made eye contact, but it was too fast to say hi, so... hi." This was the first time I have ever slid into someone's DMs. I was anxious. Normally, the only place I do some sliding is at water parks and cha-cha slash electric slides at weddings. I put down my phone, immediately picking it back up to reread my message 20 times to make sure it wasn't dumb, when ding, he responded. "That was you? Looking good." I was in. 3 days later, and we were meeting for dinner. I was freaking out from nerves, as evidenced by the sheer amount of bodysuits I tried on, overanalyzing each crotch-hugging look in the mirror before trying on the next. What if it's not a date in his brain, I thought. What if he's just being nice, and here I am showing up with date-level cleavage? What if we run out of things to talk about in the first 5 minutes, and it's just awkward silence over our entrees? What if he tries to kiss me? Oh, my God. What if he doesn't try to kiss me? I was filled with more what's than the beginning of Macklemore's thrift shop, but all that anxiety dissipated when I got there. It was easy to talk to him, and he seemed like the nervous one. The date ended up being off-the-rails fun. Fuck, I thought to myself. Here I am on my first date in more than 10 years, and I already like this guy. Is this too much? Should I pump the brakes? I proceeded to do what anyone going through inner turmoil does. I questioned my decision, and then I rationalized it. Brain, you should be playing the field. Heart, I hate sports. Brain, you gotta sow your wild oats. Heart, I have zero interest in farming. Our dinner date turned into dominating the jukebox at my favorite dive, making out at my house, and then saying goodbye early the next morning because we both had flights to catch. We were both going to be gone for a week and a half, and I was curious to see if that meant any communication. I didn't know what the rules were on this type of thing, but I didn't have to wonder for too long because he texted me midday. We continued texting a few times a day, just casual, cute, what are you up to stuff. 4 days after our first date, he asked me when I was coming back. Me. I'm headed to North Carolina tomorrow to meet my new niece, but I'll be back Monday. Him. You're kidding me. I'm going to North Carolina tomorrow for 4 days. We should meet up. Okay. Are you fucking serious, universe? First, I manifest the dude I'd met once to pull up to the same stop sign as me. Now we were going to be hanging out in my home state? I released the emergency brake in my brain. This was an Indiana Jones-style boulder coming down the hill, and there was no stopping it. For the sake of word count, I'll speed up the next 2 months. We hung out a few times a week, going to concerts, overnights at the beach, and comedy festivals, and every night ended with dancing. We were having a blast. One night, he asked me if I was his girlfriend. I was terrified at the idea of being someone's person again, but looking at him in that seedy bar in Santa Monica after another perfect night, I said, "Of course." It was fast, and it was magical, and it was over before I knew it. At one point around the 2.5 month mark, we couldn't see each other for 10 days because of travel schedules. But still, because we were a modern couple, we FaceTimed every night. He sent me love songs to listen to. I would send him cute selfies that looked effortless, but probably took 60 pics for every one sent to make sure I looked hot. And then, when we were finally in each other's presence again, he sat up and turned to me and exhaled. I knew it was coming from that one breath. I literally said, "Holy shit, you aren't doing this to me," off a single exhale. And I was right. It took all of 5 minutes for him to tell me he just had a little voice in his head saying it isn't right, as I paced and shook my hands like the Crazy Eights improv exercise. I was shocked. I didn't need details. I didn't need to hear how great I was, that I was the kindest, funniest person he's ever dated. I needed to get the fuck out of his apartment because he didn't want to be with me, and I didn't want more words to replay and overanalyze in my head later. I walked out of his building in complete shock. I felt like I'd been in a car crash, one that you don't see coming. You're just punched in the face by airbags. The type where you walk away from the wreckage fine, but you can't believe everything is totaled. You don't know whether to bawl your eyes out or scream at the top of your lungs or just laugh because it's all so surreal. And there they were. Those feelings. Those things that I felt I was missing out on in my 20s emerged, and damn. Suddenly rejection and heartache and being alone didn't sound that glamorous. When I got home, I broke out one of those wine glasses that fits a whole bottle, filled it to the brim, and took down the whole thing before passing out from ugly crying exhaustion. The next morning, I woke up with the kind of hangover that happens when your body is suffering from equal parts dehydration from drinking and crying. In a rare moment of morning motivation, I decided to take my friend Sarah up on her offer to go to Pilates and distract myself. The struggle was already real from the wine I drank the night before, but the combination of a 2-minute plank and Robin's dancing on my own blasting through the speakers broke me, and I started crying in plank position. Normally, I was humiliated in plank pose because I could barely hold it for 30 seconds. Now I was trying to hold in my abs and my tears. I couldn't do it. I walked over to Sarah, who was still in perfect form, and crouched down. "I gotta get out of here. Will you take care of my mat for me?" I whispered. "Of course, babe. I'll text you after," she said. That bitch wasn't even winded. Back home, I didn't know what to do with myself, so naturally, I checked his social media. Ladies, gentlemen, whoever is getting fucked over by someone, for the love of Beyonce, do not check that person's social media. Why? Because while your new pillowcase is tie-dyed from mascara tears, that mofo will be posting a new haircut selfie with a smirk. A damn smirk! I tried to play music to distract myself, but with every skip of the Pandora station, I was smacked in the face with some sort of tie-in tune. It got desperate, y'all. And by that I mean, I listened to Fetty Wap. I don't even like Fetty Wap, but there I was, sadly dancing in front of Beans to Trap Queen. Even Fetty's monotonous singing made me think of this dude. And I get high with my baby. I mean, technically, we never smoked weed together, but we did love to drink, so that applies. I just left the mall. I'm getting fly with my baby. He loved to shop. We went vintage t-shirt shopping on our third date and did indeed look fly. And that's when I realized I needed to turn things around. I couldn't sit alone in my house feeling sorry for myself. No, I was going to do what I do best. Invite a bunch of people over to get drunk and have fun as a means of distraction. If I was going to have a pity party for myself, I might as well make it a pity rager. I grabbed my phone and texted all my fun friends, ones from my New York days, my college days, and some YouTube buddies. Party at my house tonight. I'll have booze and tacos, 8 p.m. Quick tip. Don't invite people to a party way out in advance. The best time to invite people to a party is the day you are throwing it. Everyone who shows up had nothing else to do, and we're stoked to get that text. There's so many times we get an invite 2 weeks early, and it sounds fun, but when the day rolls around and you get that Evite reminder email, you ain't feeling it. When you throw a same-day party, everyone there wants to be there and is ready to whoop it up. I stocked my fridge with beer, covered the counter with liquor and mixers, went to the local taco place and got a full taco bar spread and 100 taquitos, and tried to keep the dude out of my head until 8 p.m. rolled around. Sure enough, when the clock struck ocho, I was decked out in a red Wrangler bodysuit, welcoming folks as they started to trickle in. An hour later, my house was packed. People were seriously throwing down. Everyone around me was knocking back shots and hula-hooping in my living room. At one point, someone was filming slow-mo videos of tortilla chips being poured over their head. As the night went on, I caught up with old friends. I laughed. I bitched about the breakup. My friend Malls brought me a card that read, "Fuck anyone who isn't obsessed with you." I pitied, and I partied, and I cried, and I laid on my bed laughing hysterically with a belly full of tacos surrounded by my buds. I felt more emotions coursing through my bodysuited bod than I'd felt in years. I didn't need to block out the sadness that was so new to me. I needed to sit in it. Take it in. This wasn't a movie I was watching. This was my life. I couldn't fast forward. I needed these lows to feel the highs. I just hadn't in so long. Everyone cleared out around 3 a.m., and I crawled into bed with beans at my side. This year is crazy, I thought to myself. But this was my test. I hadn't been bucked off a horse with my long relationship. I had done a safe dismount like an Olympian, finishing her dressage performance. This was being bucked off. And God damn it, I wasn't going to stay down. I threw the comforter off my bed, much to Beans' dismay, cranked Genuine's pony up on my speakers, and got that Wrangler up for one more dance. While this image would have seemed sad a few months earlier, now it felt empowering. Fuck anyone who isn't obsessed with you, I said into my reflection as I whipped an imaginary lasso above my head. This horse was back on its track. Get online, fellas. Remember that amazing horse analogy at the end of my previous chapter? Well, I might have been ready to hop on a hung like a horse, but the stables were empty. Trust me, I was looking. I'd even acquired a wing woman in my hunt for dudes, my also newly single friend, Veronica. Veronica, or Vero, and I had known each other from my sketch comedy days, back when we were on a team together at the Upright Citizens Brigade. We hadn't been regularly in touch since we'd both moved to L.A. 3 years earlier, but we were able to sniff out each other's singleness pretty quickly. Her, by seeing I had dropped weight, got a spray tan, and was constantly partying on my Instagram. Me, because she was posting just a few too many lyrics from Rihanna's Anti-album. No shame in our game. Vero and I became attached at the hip, prowling like two jaguars in the night, praying for prey. But no luck. People always say there's plenty of fish in the sea, but I kept casting my net and pulling up spare tires and litter. Things were not looking good for single Mamrie. If you had run into me on the street, my smile and demeanor would say, carefree and grounded, but my brain was a constant loop of two live crews me so horny. I ain't even gonna lie. Part of the reason I turned this book in late is because I was so distracted by trying to meet a guy that I couldn't even focus on writing. After a few months of doing all your traditional stuff, like going to bars and attending every party you were invited to where the host promised there might be at least one cute single dude, I found myself on a girls' trip to Hawaii with some of my faves. You've got to join Bumble, my friend Renee told me over morning Mai Tais. I don't think I can online date, I said, motioning the bartender for another round. It feels so impersonal with all the swiping. I feel like people get desensitized. It's a numbers game, Mamrie. You got to go out there and date randoms. See what it's like to go out with someone just once, or just three times, or date a few people at the same time, she continued. I put the drink's tiny umbrella behind my ear, contemplating. Maybe it was just the combination of rum drinks coursing through my body without any food in it, But for the first time ever, I was considering it. Going out to meet people the old-fashioned way sure as hell hadn't been working for me. But I have to lose. So, I bit the bullet and went into the App Store and downloaded Raya. If you haven't heard of Raya, it's basically a dating app that you have to get approved to be on. No one knows what the exact algorithm to get on it is or who the hell decides it. I like to think it's some cloaked council standing around a fire pit, holding each application's headshot up one by one and tossing the rejects into the flames. But in truth, it's probably just some straight out of college intern who checks to see if you have a decent face and number of Instagram followers. I know this sounds corny as hell, but joining it was more of a hurdle of safety than anything else. I needed to be able to cyberstalk these people to make sure they didn't cyberstalk me. Imagine this. You go out with a dude from a dating site and really hit it off, maybe even end the date with a kiss. Then when he drops you at your doorway, you run inside and immediately check his Instagram. Cool. He goes to a lot of concerts, you think. Oh, and his friends seem fun and attractive. That's a good sign. You scroll and scroll until, oh my fucking God, down in the archives there's a picture of him standing beside you at a YouTube convention meet and greet. There he is, wearing a shirt with your catchphrase on it. Now, I know this sounds insane, but it could happen. I had to take precautions. And even if I wasn't an internet person, I think some light social media stalking before a date is a good safety precaution for any woman. Within 24 hours, I was accepted to Raya. I let the app sit on my phone for the rest of the trip, profile totally blank, and didn't open it once. I'd occasionally hit it when I was trying to get to my Instagram and then would hurry and close it as if I'd accidentally FaceTime my parents. Sure, I had downloaded it, but I hadn't crossed the official threshold of being a person who online dated. For the time being, it was my little secret. But a few weeks later, when the glow of my attempt at a tan had faded and the 5 pounds I'd gained from Mai Tais had become an official resident on my belly, I sat at my kitchen counter looking at the Raya icon on my phone as my girlfriends gabbed around me. I sipped mezcals on the rocks as they regaled me with their latest dating adventures. 5 drinks in and I dropped the act. You guys? I joined Raya. The sound that came next can only be described as an a cappella group of pig squeals. My phone was immediately swatted out of my hand as they started talking over one another about what should and shouldn't be in my profile. First, they had to find the right photo. With their help, I picked one with a full smile to show my adorable gap, one with my dog, one being silly, one being sultry, and one professional photo that I had to creatively crop so it didn't have a cheesy Getty Images watermark. Next up was music. You see, this specific app had your photo slideshow play along to a 30-second clip of any song you wanted. This was a big decision. Do you go cool and put up a deep cut, like a Portuguese Bowie cover a la the Life Aquatic soundtrack? Or do you just cut to the chase and throw up My Neck, My Back by poet laureate Kaya? Within 20 minutes, I decided that the true essence of my personality could be summed up in the first 30 seconds of Mr. Brownstone by Guns N' Roses. Nothing says, click the heart on this cool-ass bitch, like the instrumental intro to a song about heroin addicts. But it was so right for several reasons. First and foremost, because I fucking love Guns N' Roses. They are the epitome of 80s Sunset Strip, no fucks given rock, a time I have always idolized. I remember being 5 when Appetite for Destruction came out and wishing I could be a hot groupie from their videos. I might have even worked the trunk of a sapling in our backyard like a pole, but there is no photographic evidence. Praise Jesus. The other reason I chose this song was because it was special to me at that exact moment. The best date I had with old Pity Party Dude was when we went to see Guns N' Roses. Both of us were huge fans, but neither of us had seen them live because, let's face it, without Axl and Slash, it's not Guns N' Roses. Seeing the authentic GNR was friggin' magical. We had floor seats, and when they hit the stage, Pity Party started bawling his eyes out. But not in a what a pussy way. In a holy shit, I'm so happy I'm getting to witness this way. It was sweet. By the second half of the show, the shock of actually seeing them live had waned, and we were just straight up rocking out. But during the final riffs of Sweet Child of Mine in the second encore, the man could not stop crying. Everyone was filing out, so we joined the crowd, but 20 yards toward the exit, and there went the waterworks again. He sat down in the nearest seat, and I gently rubbed his back, knowing that he just needed to get it all out. At one point, an employee who was trying to usher people out approached us, Ma'am, I'm going to need you to move towards the... Look, we are breaking up after 4 years. Can you please just give us a minute? I snapped back. His face dropped, eyes as big as whoopie pies. Take your time, he said, and continued herding the human cattle out of the stadium. I'd nailed it. Pity Party was clearly impressed with my quick thinking, or at least I thought he was, because meanwhile, he was internally pulling a Shania Twain. So you can convincingly portray dumping me after several years just so I can cry about a favorite childhood band for a few extra minutes? That don't impress me much. Anyway, as you can see, I adore Guns N' Roses and secretly hate that my magical night was tarnished with the subsequent garbage that went down. So I use that song as an internal anthem to show myself that I was over it. No 2 month rebound was going to ruin one of my favorite bands. I was taking that shit back. Once the girls left, it was time to start checking out what Raya had to offer. Seeing as this was an exclusive app, I was hoping for like-minded people, writers, producers, creatives. I took a deep breath and a big sip of mezcal, and after loading for what seemed like an eternity, there it was, my first offering, and it was, drumroll please, John Mayer. I nearly threw my phone across the room in disgust. I immediately hit X instead of the heart. It didn't take 20 swipes before I realized something. If you've ever watched The Bachelor, you will see how the producers strategically label the contestants' professions to either make them look great or like complete idiots. After scrolling through the app, I noticed that it was basically a rotation of only a few professions. Surely some of these guys had to be inflating their resumes. Like, not every guy can be a... One, photographer. We get it. You can afford a camera that can take a great photo. That alone does not a photographer make. Throwing an Instagram filter on a photo of a potted succulent doesn't make you a pro, people. Now, these guys weren't all posers. There were some actual editorial photographers on there. But even they didn't interest me. Most of their profiles contained way too many artsy black and white photos of nearly naked chicks. I understand that you're trying to build your portfolio, but I can't have a boyfriend who spends his afternoons with up-and-coming Russian models posing topless on a Malibu beach and expect him to be turned on when he comes home and finds me in sweatpants eating falafel with my hands. Two, writer slash filmmaker. As someone who's written a couple of movies and hopefully two best-selling books, all I have to say is, in the words of Whitney Houston, show me the receipts. In L.A., writer can sometimes be interchangeable with unemployed person who is great at staring intently at a final draft document on their laptop at Starbucks, but when no one is watching, they toggle over to Tumblr. In most cases, it didn't seem worth the risk. Three, pro surfer. I mean, come on. How many people actually make a living being sponsored by Billabong? Even if these guys weren't full of shit, a pro surfer was a no-go for me. Surfers wake up at like 4 a.m. I'm also not about that life of laying in bed next to someone who makes me want to suck in my stomach every time I'm the little spoon. A good body is great, but a great body is a pain in the ass. Despite my doubts, I had to admit that a lot of these dudes were cute, so I hit some hearts. And that is where the message stage of online dating came in. Here's what I've learned about this experience. People either come at you way too hard, or they send a message, and once you've responded, they disappear into thin air. As if they never had any intention of making a connection or having a conversation or, God forbid, a face-to-face interaction. There were a lot of these dead ends at first, but after a few days, I got into my groove and I had some real conversations happening. Being on Raya became an all-consuming process. A free 5 minutes before going out with a friend? I was on the app. Said friend gets up to go to the bathroom? I was on the app. Said friend is busy going hard on our shared app? I was on the damn app! I've never been a person who downloads games to their phone. In fact, the last time I was super into a handheld digital game was way back when I had a Game Boy. And now, I was playing a literal game of boys. I loved it. At the recommendations of my friends, I was messaging with a few dudes at once. Might as well keep my options open, right? One of the more promising ones was a pro basketball player. Sure, he was on a team on the other side of the country, and b-ball players are notorious for being players off the court, but our messaging felt like an ego boost. He was really sweet, even letting me know that my latest video was funny or my Instagram post was pretty. His team was going to play the Lakers soon after we started talking, and he said he wanted to see me. But when the time came, he ghosted. A few weeks later, I went out with a normal-seeming hot lawyer. And by the end of the night, we went back to my place for one more drink and, hopefully, multiple smooches. We cracked open nightcap beers and started playing each of our favorite songs, taking turns playing DJ. Now, I've always considered myself to have pretty great taste in music, so this was a fun flirt tactic for me. As I played him the Talking Heads, the Clash, all the top the bands, he nodded along like he loved them. We were totally vibing, that is, until he took over the tunes and started blasting the only three-letter acronym less attractive than HPV, and that is EDM. Song after song, at least I think they were different songs, but who can be sure because they all sounded the same. He tried to convince me that this act was great. They were not. There's a reason why people take so much Molly at EDM concerts. But he was into them, and I was into how excited he was. Then he played me his favorite song of all time. Guys, I kid you not when I say I sat there at my kitchen counter in total silence for the next 4 minutes as he played a Michael Bublé ballad. His eyes were closed. He would occasionally do a light air drum, and he was completely serious. You could practically hear my vagina dry up like salt on a slug. Another guy was a total hobbit. No, that is not me being an asshole and saying this guy was short and or ugly. He played an actual hobbit in the Lord of the Rings movies. We immediately had a playful repartee and said that when he was back in town, we'd go out for drinks. I told him about my newfound love for Mezcal, and lo and behold, he loved it too. A couple of weeks of casual chatting ensued, and then I got a clearly drunk text from him giving me graphic details about how he wanted to drink Mezcal off my body. It was too much. We hadn't so much as hugged in person, and I'm already learning about how he wanted to turn my body into an open bar. I retreated faster than an army realizing all their guns had been replaced by hot dogs. Discouraged, I took some time off the app while I was traveling abroad for shows. When our plane's wheels hit the tarmac at LAX, I turned on my phone to see what I'd missed. It was all the usual. A bunch of texts, too many emails from my agents, but then a ding! I'd gotten a message on Raya. I opened it, hoping it wasn't a picture of the hobbit holding up a haul from a liquor store. "I want to meet your dog," read the message from a cute boy with a sweet face. Dudes, the only thing hotter than you holding a dog is you caring about a woman's dog. I messaged him back immediately. You have great taste. From there, we playfully messaged back and forth for a few weeks until, bam, we actually made plans to meet up. And we did. And then we did again. And then again. My dating curse had been broken. But that wasn't the hard part. The hard part was learning how to not get attached out of the gate. To learn how to date, not just have a boyfriend. There's an amazing Cher quote from an interview with Jane Pauley back in 1996, where she's asked why she has referred to men in her life as dessert. She says, "I adore dessert. I love men. I think men are the coolest, but you don't really need them to live." I happened upon that old interview right around this time, and it changed my perspective. Think of men like dessert. Huh. Let them be sweet and indulgence, but not completely essential for enjoying the meal of life. It was everything I was really feeling in that moment, the exact sentiment Veronica and I had been trying to live out, but leave it to the goddess Cher to put it into the perfect analogy. She and I vowed to keep our priorities straight. We needed to be there for our girlfriends, stay laser-focused on our careers, and let guy stuff just be the icing on the cake. After all, too much dessert and you can get really weighed down and feel and look like shit. And now I was ready. The world was my proverbial buffet of various male delicacies, and I had a stack of clean plates. Just the unsolicited tips. As evidenced by the previous chapter, I'm no expert at dating. The only dating I'm good at is myself, with all these outdated references. When it comes to dating, I'm basically a fetus, as the kids would say. Hell, barely a fetus. Just a twinkle in a daddy's eye. But just because I don't know much about the subject has never stopped me from giving unsolicited advice about it. So here they are, some random gems about dating that I've picked up from my foray into singledom thus far. 1. Eat dinner. Sometimes you say you're going to go out for a quick drink on the early side with your date. Surely you'll eat a meal after you're done. Plus, you don't want to roll in with a burrito baby while rocking those high-waisted jeans that make your ass look like a tasty teardrop, right? Wrong. You must eat to preserve your integrity. Because if it's going well, one drink will become two. Two drinks will become six. And then you're either too drunk on your first date or you end up playing CSIU in the morning. I'm talking Crazy Snack Investigation Unit, which happens when you walk into your kitchen and go from crumbs to cans to shit spilled on the floor, and then you have to determine what exactly you destroyed when you came home drunk and hungry. One time, I came back from an only drinks date, and the next morning, I'd realized I'd eaten a bag of dark chocolate espresso beans, but must have not wanted to stay up all night from the caffeine, so I just sucked off the chocolate and spit out the beans directly into the garbage disposal. Another time, I woke up with little cuts on my swollen fingers because I'd eaten cold, boiled peanuts straight out of a tin can in bed. Eat dinner, you guys. 2, go out with people you have no mutual friends with. I know. There's something wonderful about dating friends or outliers of your social circle. It's like a built-in background check. You can get the skinny on their dating and job and mental health history before you ever go out. And there are a lot less introductions you have to navigate at parties. But resist. If it doesn't work out, you will be so thankful that you don't have to run into them at parties. I specifically casually date dudes on the other side of LA, which might as well be the other side of a planet, so I don't have to run into them ever again. It also saves your friends from having to choose sides when you break up. Bonus! 3, rebound basketballs, not basket cases. There is a fine line between exhilarating and erratic, and sometimes when you're blinded by like, love, or lust, it's hard to see the difference. I've seen it happen time and time again. Someone gets out of a stable relationship and is automatically attracted to someone a little wild, a change in energy. But trust me, take a step back and take a hard look at your situation before engaging. Is this person exciting or erratic? Because sure, right now it may be thrilling. You are down in the dumps, treading water, and now this person has your adrenaline pumping like you're riding a massive wave. But honey, that wave can't maintain. You're going to eventually get to the shore and have to deal with real life. You don't need an undertow of crazy constantly dragging you back in. Choose calmer waters. 4, get a hot tub. This is a costly tip, but I'm telling you, if you have the means necessary, get a damn jacuzzi and watch your social life blossom before your eyes. Your house automatically becomes the late night party spot, and you get to check out what guys look like in their bathing suits. Honestly, having my hot tub that first summer of being single was like having guy soup in my backyard, changing daily like a dude du jour. 5, always groom. Good Lord, I get it. It's annoying. I would sometimes be like, if I don't shave my legs, I definitely won't hook up. Wrong. Hair is not a chastity belt. You will get drunk, and your inhibitions will lower, and the next thing you know, your date will be busting through that bush like Wesley chopping through the fire swamp and the Princess Bride. Seriously? It's as if I only get laid when I decided to forego shaving for a week. The 3 times I have gone through the terror of a Brazilian in preparation for a night with a guy, plans have changed and we haven't hung out. I'll put it to you this way. If your legs feel like a cactus, you're probably going to catch a prick. 6, disregard my previous tip. If grooming's not your thing, or if not grooming brings you good luck, stay on course. He should be so lucky to touch your bod, even if it does feel like a bag of splinters. 7. Don't intimidate. This is not what it sounds like. I don't mean that you should shrink yourself so that the man can feel secure in his manhood, or the woman in her womanhood, or whatever Robin in his Robinhood. Quite the opposite. I mean, don't intimidate people who are intimidated by you. When you're getting to know someone, it's nice to talk about things you're working on or are proud of, whether that thing is as big as a project of yours being funded, or as simple as you starting to incorporate more leafy greens into your diet. Whatever it is, lay it all out there. If your date refers to you as intimidating, instead of just being supportive and interested in what you're saying, this is a red flag. Picture that gif of Whoopi Goldberg and Ghost saying, "You in danger, girl." Being told you're intimidating might feel like flattery in the moment, but down the road, those things your date was impressed by on your first date can fester into things your now partner resents. That's right, you can't spell impressed without pride mess. What's even worse is that sometimes in the situation, you then begin to shrink or downplay your own achievements so as to not make this other person feel bad. Don't fall for it. Don't be with someone you intimidate. Be with someone who rises up to your level, or who makes you want to step up your game and rise to theirs. You worked really hard to carve your life into the thing it is. So be with someone who stands back and admires your work, not someone who grabs an emotional chisel and chips away at it. So, in conclusion, whoa, I got a lot deeper in this chapter than I thought I would. I didn't even make one just the tip joke. The point is, I don't have all the answers. These are just things that work for me. They might not work for me a year from now. I could be rocking a full bush, have developed an irrational fear of hot tubs, and only be attracted to manic dudes who are completely daunted by any of my successes. Things change. People change. But one thing's for sure. Always eat dinner. Don't be a fool. Get a clue. I, Mamrie Hart, am a sucker for game night. Ever since I was an itty-bitty, I have loved board games. Girl Talk, Dream Phone, Mall Madness. Basically anything that was priming me to be a materialistic, boy-crazy, bitchy high schooler. But there was one game whose box wasn't hot pink that captured my heart. And that was Guess Who. Guess Who kicked every other unisex 80s board game's ass. I mean, look at the other hits of that era. Operation? I'm sorry, but if that weirdo with a bowl cut is dumb enough to swallow butterflies, a wrench, and a bucket, it might be time for evolution to just go ahead and take him out. Monopoly? A get-out-of-jail-free card? There is no such thing. We can't be teaching our youth that actions have no consequences and that you should treat your life like a simple roll of the dice. Life? Okay, don't even get me started. In what world would I spend my time playing a game that includes having to buy car insurance? So yes, Guess Who is where it was at. It was essentially a game of elimination where both players would secretly choose a character and then ask questions to find out who the other chose. Questions like, are they wearing glasses or is she a blonde could help you ID a character. Nowadays, it would be a lot more, would I ever have sex with him? Or does she look like that barista from Coffee Bean who is resting judgy face? I got so good at it that I could ask if you had a hat or glasses, take one look at my opponent's face, and know that it was Bernard. But even for a hardcore deductive reasoning kid like me, after a while, the old G-dub grew stale. I needed stakes. I needed intrigue. And then I saw the movie Clue. If you're not familiar, Clue is a classic murder mystery comedy from the 80s starring Tim Curry, my favorite Curry besides Masamam. Fun fact! When Clue was released in theaters, there were three different endings, and audiences didn't know which one they were going to get. What a unique and extremely expensive way to detract from spoilers. I saw that movie when I was 8, and I was hooked. Normally, murder-related things scared me, but this wasn't murder, this was theater. I vowed that as soon as I was old enough, I would have a murder mystery party like the one in Clue. Nothing sounded more fun to me than wearing a floor-length gown, clutching my throat and screaming, "My pearls! Someone stole my pearls!" Or blowing everyone's mind when I knew that it was indeed Colonel Mustard in the library with a candlestick. Though I threw a lot of parties in my college days, I never got the murder mystery theme off the ground. I did go to college in the South, so people were less into whodunit and more concerned with who done got a fresh keg. Murder mystery parties seemed ridiculous and cheesy to most people, which, lucky for me, was the exact recipe to make something cool in hipster late aughts Brooklyn. So before I knew it, my friends were throwing murder mystery parties themselves. For those unfamiliar, this is how they work. A few days before the party, the host emails you the character you're supposed to be playing, so you can dress appropriately as well as develop a little backstory for him or her. Once the party kicks off, someone will die in the first 5 minutes. And over the course of the night, the host will reveal a series of clues that leads everyone interrogating one another while still in character. It's a fun way to get friends to come out of their shells and also see which ones have taken Improv 101 at UCB. For one of these particular parties, I had RSVP'd late, and the host, my friend Alessia, had already doled out all the characters for her luau-themed evening. Rather than miss out on the affair, I volunteered to be the person who gets killed in the first 5 minutes, this person being a sleazy, mustachioed mobster. Perfect! I was going to rock a suit, draw a mustache with eyeliner, and slick back my hair with a quart of gel. I was ready for it. Alessia's place was in Queens, and I lived in Brooklyn, but what might look like a simple 3-mile straight shot north on paper was an hour-and-a-half subway ride into Manhattan, then back into Queens, or what us rednecks call going around your ass to get your elbow. However, I'm a professional actress. I wasn't going to show up at her house in my street clothes and then get changed there. I needed to roll up in character so as to not risk losing the illusion of my fellow attendees. Surely a woman dressed as a mob boss in a ruffled shirt isn't going to turn a head on the goddamn New York City metro system, I thought. I've seen a man naked from the waist down, wearing shoes made out of duct tape, take a shit in the middle of a subway car while singing Memories from Cats, and still some passengers stayed just to not have to lose their seat. My plan was thwarted, however, when the train broke down and I had to stand on a crowded platform for an hour waiting for another train. You can go check out a picture of just how attractive I looked as this mobster. Yeah, it was a rough time in my 20s. I'd recently quit smoking and gained some weight. While I had a blast at these parties and got blasted, they always felt like such open and closed cases. The killer would be found before you'd gotten your share of hummus. In case you haven't noticed, I like to go full tilt in my quest for fun. Put simply, I needed a full weekend experience dedicated to using my detective skills. But life happens, and schedules fill with responsibilities. Free time needs to be delegated to gross things, like visiting family. Ugh. So when planning adventures for this book came up 5 years later, I was beyond prepared and had already been eyeing a spot. There was a murder mystery weekend on Jekyll Island, a little vacation spot off the coast of southern Georgia. The Jekyll Island Club rang a bell for some reason, and then I remembered where I'd seen this historic masterpiece, on the Bravo Channel's magnum opus, Southern Charm. In Bravo's top-notch roster of Top Chef and The Real Housewives of City Where Everyone Screams Constantly, Southern Charm was like the turd in their crown jewels. In the first 3 seasons alone, there were multiple pregnancies, a train wreck of a state Senate campaign, and an evil matriarch who rang a bell when she wanted a martini. It's basically a telenovela, but with a lot more bourbon and Lily Pulitzer luggage. But despite these types of reality shows always being packed to the gills with dramatic thrills, they're always crazier when the characters are on vacation. This was especially true when the Charleston gang headed south for the weekend at Jekyll Island. Could it be that this place was named after Jekyll and Hyde and made people's personalities change? Would I become mad with power or paranoid after a few clues? Or leave the island knocked up by a potential state senator with a definite cocaine problem? I knew I needed to have an excellent partner in solving crime for this trip, so I invited my old pal, Megan. Megan, based on my side-eye observations of her at those New York City parties, was a finessed interrogator, never breaking character for a second, a veritable Meryl Streep of her craft. She was a perfect choice. Before we knew it, we were driving over a bridge and onto the little island. It was gorgeous. Spanish moss hung from the massive southern oak trees. The buildings were perfectly maintained, all white columns and wooden shutters. We rolled up slowly to avoid hitting people riding on their golf carts and beach cruiser bikes. It was just like the Southern Charm episode. Surely someone would throw a mint julep in my face in no time. We checked into the hotel and received our itinerary. Essentially, the murder mystery would be active during all the meals of the weekend. We would meet for cocktails and dinner that night, all 3 meals the next day, and a closing breakfast on Sunday where the truth would be revealed. The rest of the time was ours to chill out and or obsess about our theories. We popped into our definitely haunted room and got ready for the opening dinner. Walking over to the cocktail hour, I was already nervous, and not just because I'd already convinced myself that the ghost of a Civil War soldier had watched me get dressed. Megan and I had booked this trip on such a whim that we didn't really know what to expect. Are y'all here for one of the weddings? The bartender asked as we sat at the old mahogany horseshoe-shaped bar. Oh, no, I replied between sips of my martini. We're here for the murder mystery. Really? He said, his eyes scrunching up before turning back to the register. Megan and I exchanged a what-the-fuck-was-that look. But before we could ask the bartender if these things were lame or if he was just being judgmental, he had pulled his till out of the register and was being swapped out for a fresh bartender. As soon as we entered the mystery ballroom, we understood his We looked out over a sea of men in polo shirts and pleated khakis and women in their finest pastel dresses from Talbots and sensible kitten heels. It was like walking into a mixer for recently divorced sexagenarians or a welcome reception for new timeshare owners. We knew out of the gate we should probably mingle and get a head start on cracking the case. But instead, we headed straight to the buffet so we could load up on carbs. Mama didn't raise no fool, 'cause when I'm back in the South, there's not a lot of vegan can eat. Just like back in the Poconos, my plate was a beacon of beige, a castle of carbs, a citadel of starches. Before I could ask the chef if they were going to refill the mashed potatoes, A woman tapped on the microphone. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Jekyll Island murder mystery. Everyone golf-clapped and found a seat. My name is Margot, and I am so excited you all decided to join us this weekend. Well, some of you decided. A collective ooh spread across the room as Margot continued. Some of you here are not who you say you are. And it is your job this weekend to figure out who and why. And on Sunday, all will be revealed. Now, to get started, why don't we stand up table by table and introduce ourselves? Your name, what you do for a living, whether you're a murderer or not. I'm kidding. Margot really liked her own joke. One by one, tables rose and people gave their intros. For the most part, it was a lot of retired teachers or contractors. When it came time for Megan and I to do our thing, I could feel eyes glaring at us. Sure, we weren't the usual crowd. Both young, in comparison, redheads, with Megan covered in tattoos. But damn, they were looking at us like we were holding bloody butcher knives and matching shirts that read, I Heart Murder. Hi, my name is Megan. I live in New York City, and I own a vintage clothing company. Whispers weave throughout the tables. She sat back down, gesturing that I now had the floor. Hi, my name is Mamrie, and I'm an alcoholic. Blank faces from the crowd. This was not my audience. I'm not. I'm kidding. I mean, maybe I am, but okay, this isn't the place. Okay, sorry. Again, I'm Mamrie. I live in Los Angeles, and I am a writer. Audible gasps. Go to iTunes right now and look up Shocked Crowd of Adults, and that is verbatim what we heard. No gasp off the alcoholic joke, but plenty from the actual facts of my life. Now, most of the guests were so vanilla that I can't remember any of their names, but allow me to go down the roster of the key players who stood out to me. The Long Island sisters. The only siblings of the batch, these two were a straight-up SNL sketch, and I loved them, despite the fact that they were clearly talking about us every time they went out on one of their several smoke breaks. Bucket Hat and Hottie. This girl in her late 20s was PDAing all over her dude in his late 50s. I'm never one to judge a May-December romance, but I am one to judge a bucket hat. They're unforgivable. I don't care if you are Idris Elba in a three-piece suit holding a tray of warm cookies. If you throw a Gilligan hat on that dome, it's done. Parents, if you don't want your teenage son getting a girl pregnant, just convince him that bucket hats are back in style. Dagger eyes and cheese. As soon as we walked in the door, this woman stared Megan and me down. If for one second you think I'm paranoid, please know that she literally did the I got my eyes on you sign language with two fingers pointing towards me before she introduced herself. Her husband, on the other hand, was a lovable big dude with a wide smile and kind face. Dagger eyes clearly wore the pants and even introduced him. This is my husband, Cheese, and yes, that is his God-given name. You can't make this shit up. Real estate douches. Other than us, this was the only younger duo. Both in their mid-20s, the young Guido-looking dude was wearing a suit, and his girlfriend donned a short red dress. Apparently, they were both real estate agents in Atlanta. I was immediately suspicious. As soon as we were done with intros and everyone went back to their meals, the doors to the ballroom burst open. In ran a woman, I could tell only by the lack of sports bra, with a mask over her head and a fake gun. I screamed. None of this, oh, my pearls, feigned surprise yelling that I pictured myself doing. I straight up screamed bloody murder and was practically perched on top of Megan's head like a spooked cat. Can't be sure if I yelled, oh, shit, or not, but based on the way Dagger Eyes was shaking her head at me, I'm going to go with yes. The masked woman got 20 yards in when we heard a man's voice yell, freeze! Back of the door was a man in a Hawaiian shirt, and yes, another bucket hat, holding up a fake gun at the perp. Put down the gun and back away slowly, he yelled in a New York accent. But Titty Bandit was having none of it. She raised her gun and bang, bang, shots were fired. When the smoke cleared, and not from the Long Island sisters vaping at their table, the masked woman lay on the ground. Hawaiian shirt moved to the middle of the room, standing above the lifeless goon. Lifeless except for scratching the mosquito bite on her ankle. Wasn't surprised she wasn't committing to this role, considering she didn't even get a line. Ladies and gentlemen, there's no need to panic. My name is Rocky, and I'm a professional detective. I was on my way to Disney World when I got tipped off about a hit that had been put out here on Jekyll Island. I immediately turned my car around and came straight here. Except for those two stops at Chick-fil-A. Oh, no, Rocky was a hoot! He reached down to the masked body and pulled a business card out of her shirt pocket. Looks like we have a first clue, he said and began reading the card. He'll be on her right. Don't mess this up. Interesting. So the hit was for a couple, but the message was vague. Did someone want the man dead or the woman? Our mission was to find out not only who the hit woman's target was, but also who hired her to make the hit. I went to look at the corpse one last time to see if there was a clue that Rocky missed, but that bitch had already sprung back to life and was scooping up Alfredo sauce at the Build Your Own Pasta Bar. So much for staying in character until you cleared the curtains. We got a big weekend of crime solving ahead of us, everyone. We will reconvene at breakfast, but for now, get some rest.